look what he did at the currency exchange, therefore he intended to defraud the bank. And the U.S. attorney answered that question in the negative. The information, which was the charging instrument in this case, did not make any allegations about cashing checks for cash. The information did not contain any tax counts. The scheme did not discuss any tax practices or recording of information for deductions. The tax was not mentioned in the charging instrument. Now, I would admit that the evidence that did come in may have been admissible for a limited purpose, and that would be to probe the defense expert's charts. The question was, you didn't take into account these checks, and the government did ask that question. But the problem here is that the government went two steps beyond that. First of all, it was the government that introduced the subject of illegitimate tax practices into this case. The defendant didn't raise that issue. The government pursued it. Second of all, by the time of closing arguments, the government didn't argue this evidence for the limited purpose of probing former agent Williams's charts. It argued, I think it's a fair inference from this record, for propensity purposes. Because of the checks for cash, Mr. Maher was an illegitimate businessman. He was dishonest. He was dirty.
The defense theory, Mr. Martin, was that Maher and his wife put in more money than they took out, right?
That's correct. That they didn't have intent to defraud because they were taking steps to rescue the business.
Right. So if under this analysis there's $600,000 missing from cash,
yes.
Why isn't that relevant?
Well, it's relevant for that purpose, but to go one step beyond that, as I said, it would be relevant to test the charts, test the agent's calculations and his analysis, but to go one step beyond that and then put in evidence about tax penalties and illegitimate deductions, which is
I thought what they were just pointing out is what an unusual business method that would be if these were really for cost of goods sold.
They did, but they... it wasn't just one question. They asked a lot of questions on it of the defense agent. Then they called their own expert in rebuttal to affirmatively state that he used to be an IRS agent.
And were there any objections to this?
There were objections prior, just to take it in chronological order, because I know the government's made a substantial plain error argument in this case. Before trial, the defense...
I'm talking about at the time... That the defense witness testified.
When the defense witness testified, there were two objections. One objection was to the scope of the dates that the agent was talking about, which really doesn't relate to what we're talking about. And then the second objection was to the evidence of $1.3 million.
That
was sustained.
Right. Okay.
Then when the rebuttal agent testified, the defense did object. They asked for a sidebar when they got into the issue of the tax evidence. The sidebar was denied, and then when the jury recessed, the defense made a motion for mistrial. So that's where the objections were made. The government assumes arguendo that perhaps this evidence is 404B, and we would suggest that the way that it got into evidence really deprived the district court of an opportunity to exercise discretion, because before trial, the government indicated that this evidence would come in by way of a currency exchange witness, and the cash for checks objection was included in the rendition of the proffered facts that the government would admit. Then the government doesn't call the currency exchange evidence, and it kind of slips in during the cross-examination of the defense expert and in the rebuttal case. We do not believe this evidence was admissible on the issue of intent for the reasons we argued. It would not be relevant under 404B or 401, whichever way that controversy is going to come out. The government did not adduce sufficient proof that the defendant was the actor. Under Huddleston, under 401, the government still must prove that it's the defendant that committed the bad act. In this case, he did not sign a single check. There was no evidence that he actually cashed the checks, and there were no witnesses who testified that he received any of the money. So that prong of the 401 analysis or the 404B analysis was not met, but also the district court didn't have an opportunity to weigh that the way this evidence came in. As I said in closing argument, it's a fair inference that the government went beyond the limited purpose which it believes the evidence was admissible for. On appeal, it says it's admissible for intent. You have to be careful when you're dealing with intent because intent and propensity often overlap. In this case, what the government argued, and they argued it twice, both in their opening closing argument and in the rebuttal argument when the defense didn't have a chance to answer, that Mr. Marr basically was a crook because of these checks for cash, which the government didn't even show that he received or he cashed or he signed. And that's the prejudice that we believe exists in this record. If there's no further questions on that issue, turning to the jury instruction argument. Mr. Marr was indicted over 8 years after the last wirings in this case. The instructions only required the government to prove that he defrauded the customers, but those standing alone, those would be time-barred offenses. The instructions expressly took away from the jury the issue of whether the defendant intended to defraud Palos Bank. So the verdict in this case only represents a conclusion on a time-barred offense. Now, I understand that this court has had some recent experience with a similar issue in the Schrader case, which ironically the government didn't cite, but I cited yesterday on what was called a convergence issue. And the court held in that case that the victim of the fraud, the intent of the fraud did not have to run to the victim of the fraud. That issue is actually up before the United States Supreme Court now. In the Loughran case, which we cited in our reply brief, cert was granted after we filed our brief. In the Loughran case, it deals with the bank fraud statute, which is modeled after the mail fraud statute, which is modeled after the wire fraud statute. And I've read the petitioner's brief in that case, which has been filed. The response hasn't been filed. And he is making really the same argument that we're making here, that in a fraud case, the intent to defraud must run to the victim.
That's under the bank fraud statute?
It's under the bank fraud statute.
Okay.
That may be a distinction. It may not be a distinction. We believe there's a difference between reliance on false statements by the victim. We acknowledge that's not an element of mail fraud, but that's different from whether the intent to defraud must run to a particular victim that is within the scope of the statute of limitations.
Well, since the statute of limitations exception is written not in terms of intent to defraud the bank or any particular victim, but in terms of simply affecting
That's correct.
The financial institution, what's wrong with this jury instruction?
Well, it under the court's law, as it presently stands under Serpico, the jury instruction is not error. The definition of effect has never been defined by the Supreme Court. There is somewhat of a dispute among the circuits. There's at least one case from the Fourth Circuit that says the intent to defraud must run to the victim, and it is possibly, and we would hope, an issue that the Supreme Court may address in the Loughran case where the intent to defraud runs. These statutes have to be reined in. The government can't be given all this free latitude to charge these time-barred offenses. Statute limitations are supposed to be interpreted liberally. In this case, giving a strict definition to the word effect would give liberal interpretation to the statute limitations. If there are no further questions, that's even into my rebuttal time.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Martin. Thanks. Mr. Edenfield.
May it please the Court, Scott Edenfield for the United States. The District Court's judgment and sentence in this case should be affirmed. None of the three arguments offered by the defendant warrant reversal in this case. The checks and currency exchange evidence introduced by the government was direct evidence of the charged wire fraud of the case, and accordingly the District Court did not commit error when it did not exclude that evidence pursuant to Rule 404B. There was no error in the jury instructions because the district court correctly informed the jury that it did not need to find the defendant intended to harm a financial institution. And finally, the restitution order to Palace Bank was proper under the Mandatory Victim Rights Act. On the first issue, the evidence introduced about the checks evidence was directly relevant and was direct evidence of the charge scheme. The defense introduced the evidence through Mr. Williams and introduced that evidence to disprove the intent element of the crime. In response, the government challenged that evidence by showing the net outflow of over $600,000 that was not accounted for in Mr. Williams' analysis. That evidence went directly to the intent of the intent charged in the crime. It involved acts that took place during the time frame of the charge scheme and acts that took place as part of and in furtherance of the charge scheme. So the evidence of the check cashing and the currency exchange was in fact direct evidence of the charge crime.
What ties that evidence to William P. Marr rather than to his father?
The evidence that ties that to William P. Marr, Your Honor, is first, the evidence adduced at trial was that William P. Marr, and not his father, was the individual who was who was running Equipment Source. He was the one in charge of the day-to-day activities of Equipment Source. And second, as Mr. Williams adduced during his direct examination, there was a substantial inflow of money to the Palace Bank accounts of Equipment Source, both from a home equity line of William P. Marr, as well as his wife's bank accounts. So it would be reasonable for the jury to infer from that evidence that the cash and checks going into the account were from William P. Marr, his equity line, and his wife. The cash going out of the account was going to the same sources, Your Honor. So that would be the evidence tying the checks and currency exchange.
I gather they were both he and his father were signatories on the business checking account.
That is correct, Your Honor. So because that evidence was direct evidence of the charged crime, the district court did not commit error when it admitted it. As the court noted a moment ago, this was also evidence that was not challenged or objected to at the time, and thus a plain error standard applies upon review.
But what do we do with the tax arguments, though, that were raised? The implication that this was fishy from a tax standpoint.
And, Your Honor, there wasn't in the record a direct reference to this was fishy for tax purposes. Well, what happened in the order that the evidence came in was Mr. Williams stated more money went in than went out. And the government's rejoinder to that evidence was no. In fact, if you account for the $600,000 that Mr. Williams didn't account for, that's not the case. More money went out than went in. What Mr. Williams then volunteered during cross-examination was, well, some of that money that you're talking about, that $600,000, was in fact for cost of goods sold. And we know that because it's entered on the memo lines of some of the checks. The government's rejoinder to that second line of defense by Mr. Williams was to point out that the memo line on the check was not dispositive, of course, of what that went to. And the way that the government did that was by asking, based upon Mr. Williams' experience as a revenue agent, and then later of Mr. Killian, based on your experience as a revenue agent, are those memo lines dispositive? Would that allow a business deduction based solely on those memo lines? The government in no way ever said that the Equipment Source or Mr. Marr did anything that was false, made any false statements on their taxes. It simply argued that this is not how a company would do this if it were trying to have these count as business deductions, which then indicated that the evidence was supported what the government argued, that in fact there was money flowing outside of this, money flowing out of the Equipment Source accounts through the cash and currency exchange.
Am I remembering correctly the language from the closing was dirty and sneaky?
Your Honor, yes, that is correct. And that was a rejoinder to an argument in the defense's closing. The defense's central tenet in closing was, you know, Mr. Marr was a businessman who failed. He didn't intend to defraud. He was simply a person who embarked upon a business, and that business failed. And a failed business does not equate to fraud. And the government pointed both to this evidence as well as to the rest of the evidence in the case to show that that was, in fact, not the case, Your Honor. So because the evidence that was introduced of the check cashing and the currency exchange was direct evidence, and even if the court concludes it was not direct evidence, was properly admitted under Rule 404B, the position of the government is that the district court did not commit error in allowing that evidence, and that the court's judgment as well as its sentence should be affirmed. And if the court has no further questions, I appreciate
Thank you, Mr. Edenfield. Mr. Martin?
As respectfully on the plain air point, the government doesn't take into account the pretrial 404 objections, which were brought to the district court's attention, and both in writing and orally. And those objections included a discussion of the cash for checks evidence.
And what did the district judge say before trial about this?
What he said before trial was he was going to allow the currency exchange witness to testify. He did use the words that he was not going to issue a final ruling if the defendant could bring something forward to show a lack of foundation in terms of the time period. That was a conditional aspect of his ruling that did not come to fruition, but it's pretty clear from the substance of the court's ruling it was allowing the currency exchange witness to testify.
But not a final ruling.
He did use those words.
Yeah. That's a pretty clear signal that if it comes in, you need to object then, right?
Well, but if you read the colloquy, it was tied into the defense wanted to look at some records to see if the time frame was off. But as far as he said, I'm going to allow the witness to testify. That was the substance of his ruling, and the defense could ask for a limiting instruction, which they did not ask for at the end of the case because they didn't want to highlight the evidence that was discussed. In terms of whether Mr. Marr ran the business, what the government relies on in this case is a pretty slim read. It was a testimony of a young man who worked there for a couple of weeks. He was the stepson of a woman who dated one of the employees. Against that, you have the evidence that Mr. Marr's father owned the business. He signed all of the checks. He was the one who entered into the merchant agreement with the bank, which was really where the heart of this dispute lie. He oversaw the business as well, and that was testified to by witnesses called by the government. So this evidence of Mr. Marr being the mastermind of this and receiving all the cash from the checks is non-existent.
All right, thank you, Mr. Martin.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Edenfield. Mr. Bindi. The case is taken under advisement, and the court will stand in recess.